62 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackanddrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I'm really happy to be sitting opposite two good friends and one very frequent guest to the morning show. That would be Doug Instanis, who is, of course, director of the Racine Theater Guild. And with him today, Kim Instanis, associate professor of theater at Carthage. And they are here together on the morning show to talk about a really incredible trip which they experienced not long ago. They made their way to Edinburgh, Scotland. Kim Instanis with a group of students from Carthage. It was actually a J-term in June, sort of a J-term course that took them to the so-called Fringe Festival in Edinburgh, Scotland. And Doug made his way over there for 10 days of that three-week period. And so they together experienced what has been described as the largest and most important artistic and theatrical festival in the world. And we're going to hear from them directly just how large and how amazing and even sometimes crazy this festival is, that draws in performers from all around the world, and actually not just theatrical performers. And if all of this sounds vaguely familiar, it might be because earlier in the summer we had a conversation with four people involved in the University of Wisconsin Parkside's production of Boswell, which went to the Fringe Festival. And the Carthage Theater Department sent Eric Simonson's Up and Away. And so we want to make special mention of those two local productions that were part of this year's Fringe Festival. So Doug Instanis, Kim Instanis, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Good morning.
Morning. Thank you.
Kim, I got to talk with you first directly, although I hope your proud, happy husband will chime in. Earlier this year, you were named Carthage's Distinguished Teacher of the Year, which is a, of course, tremendous honor, and I just know so many people who were thrilled about that. Can you tell us a little bit about when you first heard that this honor was going to be bestowed on you? I know once upon a time they used to spring it on people as a complete surprise. They have chosen to not do it that way anymore.
Right. No. Provost Timmerman came to the costume shop, actually, and if you know where the costume shop is at Carthage, it's a little bit off the beaten path. And so I was a little surprised because I wasn't sure why he was there.
You wouldn't stumble into the costume shop on your way to any place else.
No, you would not. You have to make a special trip to make it to the costume shop. So he came in and just started talking to me and sort of told me, and that was in March, and, you know, told me that I was going to be the Distinguished Teacher of the Year. And I have to admit, I was flabbergasted. And then that was March, and I had to keep a secret until May, which was probably the hardest 2 months of my life, right, trying to keep it a secret from everybody for 2 months.
So. Although not a secret from Doug, I would assume.
I did ask special request to tell my family. So,
and I couldn't tell for 2 months. You know how hard it is not to brag about your wife? I know something you don't know.
Yeah, that is tough, but that's just great. So let's just learn a little bit about how you got into this whole business of costume design. I know you studied it in college because part of your time at UW-Whitewater was with my best friend, Marshall Anderson, who's still the costume
That's
head there.
Right.
But I don't know what got you on this path in the first place?
Oh, well, I was raised in Midwest, or like the middle of Wisconsin, central Wisconsin, and I was part of a 4-H club there, which everybody, when I was a kid, was part of a 4-H club or part of FFA, right? Future Farmers, right?
So did you grow up on a farm? I mean, when you were a farm girl, or just a rural girl?
I was a rural girl. We had farm animals and we did that kind of thing, but I mostly did 4-H for the sewing and, you know, knitting and sort of craft kind of things. And so when I went to college, of course, I was a poor college student. I needed a job. I went to the job fair on campus, and the costume shop was there looking for someone to sew. And I thought, wow, you know, like, who knew I could get paid to do this, right? I had no idea, actually, that you could be a costume designer, that anybody did that, you know, from anywhere. And so when I asked, you know, I went to apply, they asked me what the most complicated garment I had made was. I told them I made my brother's three-piece suit for eighth grade graduation, and they said, you're hired, because nobody had ever come to them and said, I've made a three-piece suit as an 18-year-old, you know. So, and I started working in the costume shop. I figured out that you could be a costume designer, and I never looked back. I was going to be an English major. I changed my major. I worked in the costume shop all the time. And then I decided I wanted to go to graduate school, and it's just, I mean, I guess it's history, right? Like, that's, if I had not had that job or not seen that job application, I probably would be an English teacher now.
Wow. Ahead of that, so you were going to be an English major, so you had at least some interest in literature and the written word. Did you have much of an interest in theater before that?
No, not at all. I mean, I was in the pit band. I played, you know, oboe in the pit band. But no, not at all. Huh. I had no idea that that's what I was going to do with my life.
Right. Well, and it occurs to me that I suppose somebody theoretically could be a costume designer and not be all that interested in the theater, or not even all that aware of, in a sense, the theatrical world. But I assume as time has gone on, you've been drawn into kind of theater in the whole. I mean, not just your little slice of it in terms of the costume design.
Oh, right. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess I liked musicals. You know, I think some people start there because that's a more mainstream way in. But actually, I guess, you know, I did like Shakespeare. We read a lot of Shakespeare in high school in my English class. And so I kind of understood that. But I definitely dove more into it and really enjoy designing all kinds of shows now. So, yeah.
So what has been the aspects of costume design that have felt completely natural versus those aspects of it where you had a lot to learn and maybe, you know, had the most room to grow?
Well, I definitely had experience sewing, and I think some natural talent, I guess, is in that area from, you know, sewing from age 8. You know, I had a lot of experience in that. I love research, so I can do research all day and all night, right? I could research anything. I love to do research. Probably my weak link is, you know, sort of fantasy, outside the box kind of design. You know, I like to do historical period stuff, but, you know, trying to do. So I think I had to learn a lot in that area. And I think I did actually do in graduate school. We had I had a really great mentor who made you stretch all those boundaries. So
when it comes to you to design costumes for a given show, at least in brief, and in fact, it really has to be in brief. I'm sure you're going to have to really simplify what I'm sure is a complicated process. But essentially, what happens between that time that you have a blank sheet of paper in front of you, and that paper gets filled with some kind of design, which then you ultimately build. Typically, what happens between those two points?
Okay, I can do this. Well, you start by reading the play, obviously, and then you have production meetings with the rest of your production team, which includes a director and the other designers and lighting and set and props and those kind of places. And you get the concept from the director. How are we approaching this particular play? And once I know what that concept is, I go away. I do a lot of research. Thank God for the internet because, you know, you get to do a lot more. It used to be you had to go to the library and make photocopies. But I still go to the library, don't worry, and do a lot of research on each of the characters and the play and social history and etiquette. And, you know, it's not just about designing the clothes that the characters are wearing. It's also knowing why they wore them, in what context they wore them. Did they get it handed down to them? Did they buy it new? Like, there's just a whole list of things. I always say that I could also use a psychology degree to help me with this. Would be great. And then I go back. Then we go back to the production meeting, and we look at research, and then we look at sketches, and then we'll look at fabric and color choices, and I'll do a final. Finally, the paper will be full of a rendering that's got full color and fabric choices, and then the director, of course, you know, weighs in on whether they like that or they want something else, or and so that's how it gets to that point, right? And then that is sort of like a ground plan. Gets actually taken to the costume shop, and the costume gets built from that there. So that rendering, that's how that rendering happens.
Right. Of course, when we see up close a set on a stage, it isn't, for instance, stairs on a stage. They're not the same as the stairs in your home. And the wall is not the same as a wall in your home. What is the difference between the costumes that actors wear on the stage and the actual clothes that someone might have actually worn in that time and place in which the play is set? What is the difference, if there are significant differences?
There are a few differences. The clothes that someone wears are, you know, of course, made to be worn, but not made to be worn 8 performances a week and laundered, you know, every other day. And so when we build something, or even if we buy something, if you looked on the inside would be different. You know, the inside would be a little more supportive. It would be, it would have, you know, pit pads for sweat. It would have, you know, so things that maybe we wouldn't wear in real life. It's also, the costume is also really about the character. And so there are going to be character choices made to add to those costumes. So even if it's a 60s dress, it's a 60s dress that, you know, a character from that play wears. And maybe there's a little, you know, maybe there's a color that they like, or there's a pin that they're going to wear to go with it. And so I think as humans, we wear those same kinds of things. We make those choices. But as a costume designer, I'm making the choice for the character that... Mm.
And does it make a big difference that you are designing something that is going to be seen from a distance more than we would see a piece of clothing from somebody we just encounter in real life?
Oh, yeah, sure. Making scale choices, making pattern choices, you know, on an opera stage, you're never going to see a little tiny flower print on something. So you're always going to choose something bigger in scale, you know, a bigger flower, a bigger stripe, a bigger whatever. Lots of times distress, you know, we will have to distress the clothes or age the clothes because, you know, you went to the store and you bought a brand new flannel shirt, but the farmer in the play has been wearing that flannel shirt for 25 years. So you have to distress that. And sometimes you can, in a closer setting, you're going to see that distressing a little bit better than from, you know, again, 30 feet away in an audience. So
can I throw in something?
Please.
Because I've worked with a lot of costume designers. Kim is different in a way that I think what you're getting at is when they say, well, it's only theater, you know, that doesn't fly with Kim. Kim is, I don't care if they're 50 feet away. You're going to make that hem the way it's supposed to be. You're going to line it the way it's supposed to be. I don't care if they only wear it for 5 minutes. It's going to be done correctly. Not every costume designer does that. It's kind of like, okay, we'll use the cheap material and you'll stand in the back and nobody will see it. But, you know, none of the students get away with that with Kim.
So be forewarned.
Yeah.
Right.
So you're going to line that puppy?
So how much, Kim, of your time at Carthage, for instance, is spent in the construction phase? And how much of that construction are you actually doing versus other students or maybe other employees for that matter in the costume shop?
Well, we usually spend about 4 weeks constructing a show. From it just depends, you know, if we build everything, you know, in the show. Right now we're doing the costumes for A Doll's House 2, and we're building everything. So we're starting with the underwear. They're working on that this week. And so we have about 5 weeks to do that show before we get to dress rehearsal, I think, four and a half weeks, something like that. So, you know, we're constructing that for that amount of time. I have had the great fortune to have Nicole Phillips in, who is my shop manager for the last 5 years. We've had a shop manager, and she's been the one for 3 of that. So thank goodness I do less of the actual construction part of it, because now I can focus on, you know, working with designers and teaching my classes. So she does a lot of the shop work and the draping. Actually, she does a lot of the draping. And then the students do all the sewing. Like, our students are, they do everything. A lot of them do a lot of the draping as well. And actually, one of them is going to learn to tailor. She's going to make, there's one man in A Doll's House 2, and she's going to make his suit and learn how to tailor. So, you know, the students don't get off at all at Carthage. They have to do all the work. It sounds terrible, but they're learning as they're doing it, right? That's what they're there to learn about. And even our acting students, our scene design students, our stage managers, they all work in the shop at some point and work on shows. And so, yeah. And we know I jump in there when I have to, but...
And Doug Instanis, as a experienced stage director, you're probably in a better position than anybody I know to speak to the huge difference that costumes make in whether or not a production is effective.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it even became more apparent to me when we went to Edinburgh. You know, they didn't have any sets and very little lights. It was an actor up there in a costume. And you immediately made an opinion about that actor by what they were wearing, you know, and how they used their costume and what they looked like and what period it was and what time, you know, what do I know about this person? What are they like? I mean, you see that right in the costume. And because, you know, in Edinburgh, they were moving those shows in and out, and there wasn't much set. So it all relied on the costuming. So it's very important.
Yeah.
I'm always very biased about this. I always say, you can do a play with an actor in a costume. And then the lighting person always says, but you have to have light.
You have to be able to see them.
You have to be able to see them.
All right. For those of you just joining us, speaking today with Kim Instanis and Doug Instanis, and we've been talking in this first half about Kim Instanis recently being named Distinguished Teacher of the Year at Carthage. She is Associate Professor of Theater, where she is the head of the costume department. And Doug Instanis, as of course I'm sure you know, is the director of the Racine Theater Guild. And we have both of them here today because of a trip that they took earlier this summer to Edinburgh, Scotland, to what's known as the Fringe Festival, the biggest of all of the fringe festivals. There's many fringe festivals around the world, although it looks like the proper name for this event is the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, and Kim, you were saying you know something about why it's called that.
Sure. The Fringe started in 1947 as a way to sort of celebrate the end of World War II, to get, you know, people more interested in the arts and that kind of thing. And what they had planned for some groups to come and do some performances in Edinburgh and have this celebration of the arts festival. Well, 8 groups showed up without being invited, and they just said, we would like to also participate. And so everybody said, well, I think that's a great idea, and they will just put these guys on the fringe, right? So
on the outskirts.
Right. Like, so they were kind of on the outskirts and kind of forced their way in. But I think they were accepted, you know, willingly into the group. And so they – They actually named it that, I think, a few years later. They decided that was the official name.
Interesting.
Would be.
So it started as the fringe of the Edinburgh Festival.
Right, of this arts festival. Right, right.
Right. Fascinating. And yeah. now it has grown up into this huge thing.
Huge.
Now, is that original Edinburgh Festival? Does that still exist? Or is that just dwarfed by this Edinburgh Fringe Festival?
No, I think it has grown into the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. So it's this...
All one
thing, yeah, wow. Absolutely.
So, Doug, we haven't heard enough from you yet. So why don't you tell us a little bit about kind of the nuts and bolts in general of what this event is.
Well, I'm sure I have the numbers wrong. Kim probably has them correctly, but something like 3,000 shows at 600 venues, something like that?
It's more than that, venues, but yeah.
Yeah, but like 3,000 shows over, you know, they just one after another after another after another, and the streets are packed with people trying to talk you into coming to see their show, and it's phenomenal. You can see any type of theater, performing arts, dance, music, you know, and
children's shows,
magic shows, comedians. It was just crazy. It was amazing. You know, you could spend you know, the whole month there and see a different show every day and still not even get close to seeing them all.
Wow. So how long an event is this?
It's the entire month of August.
Okay. And so you were there with this group of students from Carthage to do Eric Simonson's Up and Away. And Doug, you were there as an unattached civilian visitor.
As a squatter, I think. I flew in there and found a willing person to house me for a while. And,
there you go. Good.
And tag along with the theater group at Carthage, which were very wonderful and welcoming, and let me tag along.
Was this your first time there?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And how about you, Kim?
That was our second trip. We also took a play called No Name by Jeffrey Hatcher about 6 years ago.
Right. Tell our listeners a little bit about Edinburgh itself, the city, and then where this takes place within Edinburgh. I mean, is it just all over Edinburgh, or is it kind of like the county fair where there's sort of grounds? It doesn't sound like it's really that kind of thing.
Well, Edinburgh is the capital, I believe, right? And so there's Parliament there, and there's, what do they call the Royal Mile?
The Royal Mile.
And a lot of things happen between this Royal Mile, between Edinburgh Castle and then the Queen's Castle. Holyrood Palace, right. Mm. And so this is where 10,000 human beings are jammed in shoulder to shoulder, place to place. And, you know, they start every ballroom, every bar, every restaurant, I think, has a theater in it. You know, there are 40-seat theaters. And some of them are, when we saw one of the shows, it was in a, you know, 1,000-seat theater. Mm. But most of them are very small, intimate spaces that I think are just made for the Fringe Festival. Churches are opening up basements and things and doing that and getting people to come in. So, there, you know, every block there's four theaters on that block. So most of it's within the mile. You know, most of it's within walking distance, I believe, in my experience. You know, so you can go from one place to another place relatively quickly.
Mm. Yeah, we performed in the Radisson. There's a Radisson right on the mile. And we would perform.
You mean the hotel?
A hotel.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And we performed in one of their conference rooms. So they had set up, you know, black curtains all the way around and a seating arrangement that was sort of a thrust or like three-sided seating arrangement. And we had about 45 seats, I think, in there.
And they had three theaters in the Radisson.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, so three of their conference rooms were converted.
And that's just the Radisson.
And that's just the Radisson.
The Hilton
yeah.
across the street had three more, and then we walked right down this little cove, and there was two down there. I mean, it was just, you know, within a block, there was, eight different locations.
On one block.
Yeah.
Right. It's like a city turning into Broadway for three weeks. So I hope one of you can explain, Kim, you're probably in a little better position to explain how these productions come to be a part of each Fringe Festival. And this happens every year?
Yep, it happens every year.
So what is, because from the little I've read about it, it doesn't sound like this is exactly a juried sort of event in which you, but is there some kind of process by which you are granted access or given permission?
Actually, when the Fringe Society was formed, I think in the 1950s sometime, when they became this sort of formal thing, they decided that they were going to go with this idea that anyone could come there and perform. And so they don't jury, they don't audition. If you can find a place to do your show and a place to, and you can find the money to support yourself or have someone support you, and you can bring your actors or, you know, whatever your show is there, you can come.
Really?
Yeah. It's open to everyone.
Wow. So, for instance, then Carthage, with this production of Eric Simonson's Up and Away, they had to find a place in Edinburgh, Scotland, where they could perform it? And what,
right.
what happens with that?
Definitely this more the more modern version of it is there are production companies. And so the Fringe has a number of production companies that you can partner with that then will show you show you the ropes and how to get everything done, and they cover they'll do your printing of your flyers for you, and so it certainly has become a machine that you can find your way into. And but I think in the old days it used to be you could, if you found a place and somebody was willing to give you a space to do it in, you could come there. But it's much more organized now.
Right. Your group was called MySpace, right?
Wasn't
that the production company? And they had
The Space. It's called The Space.
The Space. They had like 10 locations, and then they produced a number of shows. And the wonderful thing about the way they did it was they allowed the production company allowed anybody who performed in their space to see other performances in their space for free. So that was one of the benefits of the students got to see all of these shows, and I got to see all of these shows for free because you were part of the same production company.
Under the same umbrella.
Under the same umbrella.
So it was a wonderful, wonderful thing that Herschel
Herschel Kruger planned. And this is the same company we used last time, and it worked really well for us because you do get, because it varies on the Fringe what things cost. And sometimes if you're out there, people give you free tickets because they just want to fill up the seats if they're not having, if they're on their first week or their last week or whatever. Sometimes it costs, a few pounds. And some of them are actually, more like 15 pounds. So it ranges quite a bit about how much you can pay to see something. And it's nice when you can set a whole set of things are just free right off the bat, and you can start with those.
So this is not like going to the State Fair or Disney World or something. You're not walking through a big gate and plunking down a big amount of money and then you can go see whatever you want to see.
You just
show up in Edinburgh and then each thing you want to see, it might cost you money or it might not, but that's how it works.
There are massive books that have all the shows and all the times, and you go, it's daunting. It's 2 inches thick of all the descriptions of all the plays, and oh my goodness, how do you decide?
Yeah.
How do you decide?
Well, I went to a lot of free ones. And then at the end, I was really interested in different spaces. You heard of some names and, some of the shows I knew, most of them you don't. But I was very interested in seeing the different theater spaces and how they use the spaces, because everything is different. Every space is different.
Well, that's one thing I wanted to be sure to ask both of you about, because that is one thing that seems like a predominant theme when you read about the event, is that it utilizes all kinds of different venues, including venues that one would say are atypical, or I don't know if there's a fancier term for it, but spaces not originally intended as theatrical performance spaces get used for this. Can you give us some sense of some of those uncommon venues that where you saw things?
Well, like I said, we were in a small conference room, so it's sort of blocked off and made to look and like the stage is just like an inch platform that's put out in the floor so that you can delineate between stage and audience, and the chairs are set pretty close. that was ours. The last time we went, it was in a church basement, in a gathering room in the church basement. And so, you know, it had wood floors and a little higher ceiling, but there was still like sort of the black curtain, and, you know, figured out how to put the set in there. I was trying to think where else we saw one.
Well, did we see sticks? That seemed to be like a school to me. We were walking upstairs, right. And there was just a little auditorium in that.
Yeah.
Of course, the National Theater was a huge,
right,
massive theater with thousands of seats.
I saw one man show in an older building, probably like an 18th century building, and it was in this curved room, kind of looked like a bunker, you know, but it was in one of the older buildings that I think on a regular basis is a multi-level bar. But this was in this space. They had painted it black, and it was curved ceilings, and it was very intimate. There was only probably like 20 chairs in there. And so that was interesting. There's a lot of street performers, so you see everything on the street, too. They have jugglers and fire eaters and
sure.
all kinds of interesting people on the street doing performances, too. So.
Wow. Well, and I think, Doug, it was you who said that this isn't just theater, that there's other kind of performance that goes on at this, including just straight music, for instance. Is that something you see or not?
Yeah. You know, I thought I was going to the Elton John show. And so I went to this nice space, and it was packed. And there was a bunch of young people with a band, and they sang Elton John songs. And that was it. No storytelling. No, they did very good. It was great. They sang well. Not once did I learn anything about Elton John, nor did I think that he was Elton John.
Okay.
But it was, you know, so there was that type of situation. You know, Kim and I saw, I don't know what best to describe it, a performance piece, a play called, or I don't know.
Performance piece, I think, is the way.
You know, called Styx, which was a 7-piece band to start with. They all had dialogue, and was the main character was being interviewed by their grandson. It was a grandson and granddaughter who were part of the band, and he was interviewing grandma, and there was a light on stage that represented grandma talking. And they interwove that with stories about grandpa who had Alzheimer's, and she was starting to have signs, and so he wanted to interview her and talk about their life. And then they had music in that, and they talked about Alzheimer's, and they had some weird lighting, and it was really cool. And at the end, they passed out shots of whiskey, and we had a toast to Grandpa, and we were all bawling our eyes out.
Wow.
It was like we knew this man, and it was so creative storytelling and theatrical, and they found some music, and he had played some of his grandfather's music, and affects Alzheimer's patients, and so all sorts of crazy things. And I saw a comedian who, you know, and we saw a name of a show we can't talk about on the air, but the last part is Antigone, which was a very heightened version of Antigone that, you know,
right,
little rated R, and crazy, just so. All different types of theater, all different types of performance art pieces. There was even a musical we did not see called Trump the Musical. So, you know, there's all sorts of things you can go to.
Now, do you have a sense that the bar of excellence is pretty high, just because, or does that wildly vary as well? I mean, you've already painted a picture of a festival that's widely varied in terms of the kind of things you see. Is everything, as far as you're concerned, very good vary as well?
I think that yes, it's wildly varied. It just depends on, you know, sort of who the people are, where they're, you know, what kind of performance it is, but as I told my students, you can learn from everything you see. And so seeing all of the variety and all the different things and talking about what drew you in and what took you out is all educational and a learning experience, and that's why we go there.
Of course.
Well, absolutely. You can learn more from a bad show than you can a good, because a good show, you just take the ride and go, oh, that was great. I love that.
Yeah.
And a bad show, you go, oh, how would I have changed that? What I have done? How would, you know, and you analyze things a little bit more.
Absolutely.
But it is quite hit and miss. And some of them are fantastic, and some of our were like, okay, how much did it cost for them to produce that? And who's bankrolling that? Because I don't know how they got that.
Right. How much of the festival are entities like Carthage College or the University of Wisconsin Parkside versus community theaters or professional theater companies, or is that also a wide variation?
I think that's also a wide variation. We did meet a number of other college groups. There are high school groups that bring shows. And then probably the majority, I would say, are people who are trying to make it into the professional world. I met a guy from Chicago, actually, who brought he's a one-man show sort of storytelling, and he brought his show to the Fringe to sort of try it out, see how it did, get some feedback from people. And then, he wants to continue to write that and possibly make that into something bigger. And so I think there are a lot of people like that, bring it here, see how it goes, see what people think about it, that kind of thing. But so there's a lot of, in that semi-professional, moving into the professional world.
Right.
I also think that they sometimes don't want you to know who they are because, I try to research them beforehand, and it's the Greg Berg Theater or the Caritas Theater or the, names that you Renegade or, the Outreach Theater. Okay, well, they don't say St. Joe's High School production of, even though they are all high school kids. Everybody's got a name for their company. We're starting a company, so we just have this company name. So it's a little hard to determine. Like I said, I had no clue that this one group was just going to be some young people playing Elton John music.
Right.
Not by the name of the show, not by the name of the company.
Right. And it sounds like some of what you see is quite experimental, maybe groundbreaking, and many things that you're seeing are, in a sense, world premieres. I mean, works you absolutely don't know. Now, on the other hand, do people come to the Fringe Festival and do Death of a Salesman or things like that?
I saw somebody was doing Grease.
And you're in town.
Yeah,
really?
Yeah.
And they did. There were a couple of companies doing Shakespeare shows, Shakespeare plays.
I saw a production of Frankenstein. It was updated version.
Now, I hope I'm not misquoting, but I think most of the shows have that time limit of about an hour to 90 minutes. Hmm. So you're doing, I did talk to, the Year in Town group was another college, they were doing the hour version of Year in Town. So, edited for the Fringe.
So I can't bring Carthage Opera Workshop to do Tristan and Isolde, which is 5 hours and 20 minutes
right.
long. Not at the Fringe Festival.
Not at the Fringe Festival. Nope.
Note to self. Note to self. Kim, I want to make sure that I give you a chance to talk about one aspect of this that is so tricky, which is the fact that not only is there a time limit in terms of how long can this piece be, but also how long do you have the venue in question where you are performing. And it sounds like that in and of itself is a real vexing technical challenge. So explain to our listeners what I'm talking about.
Sure. When you get to your time frame, you're allowed to sort of congregate outside of your venue. So we all, get our stuff together. The actors have already come to my flat and changed into their costumes and put on their makeup. And so we're all ready to go that way. We pack everything all the costumes that are going to be changed during the show into suitcases and haul them all to the venue because there's no storage space there. You have to take everything in and out with you all the time.
And how far distance are we talking?
It was about a 15-minute walk from my flat to the space. And then the students came from other places to my flat because they lived in other flats. Mm-hmm. So you congregate outside till the next show, the show before you is finished. They are doing the same thing. So they're packing up and getting all, running around getting out. They get out, you go in, you get 10 minutes to set up before the house opens. And so you have to go in, get all of your props and furniture and costumes and everything set where they need to be in 10 minutes. And then the house opens and the audience is seated in 5 minutes and then you go. So you go, you have up to an hour and a half. Our show was an hour and 25 minutes or an hour and a half, depending on the day. And then you get another 15 minutes to get out.
Wow.
So 5 minutes for the audience to clear, 10 minutes to pack it all up again and get out so the next group can come in.
Wow.
And our show started at 8:15, and there was still another show after us. So they go all hours of the day, so it's just a constant rotation of shows. So we got, like Doug said, we had it down. You know, everybody knew their job. Do your job, get it done quickly, get backstage, you know.
How did the students like performing the same play for that period of time, for basically 3 weeks solid, day after day after day after day? Was that a positive experience for them by and large?
Well, welcome to your life, because if you want to be an actor, you're going to be doing 8 shows a week for, you know, however long a show is going to run. And so I think it was a good experience for them. I think they were surprised maybe at how exhausting it could be to do that every day, especially because we really did have to, like, haul everything there and, you know, set it all up every time, which is probably not what you would be doing. But I think they all reacted very positively, though. They really learned a lot about what it is to do that kind of theater, and maybe learned a little bit about themselves as well.
Interesting. I'm trying to also get a figure out who's there to see these hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of plays. I mean, are they all Doug Instanists? I mean, you know, directors of community theaters, or, you know, theater aficionados, or is it just regular people? Are some of them from Edinburgh itself or other parts of Great Britain? Or, I mean,
I think everybody in Edinburgh leaves for the summer because they rent out their flats and they make lots of money because,
Yeah, most of the people I talk to that are from Edinburgh, if you don't work in one of the, you know, service industries, you go on vacation.
Oh, is that right?
But actually, I had asked, Doug and I had a conversation about this, because I thought, is everybody who's here just people who are doing shows and seeing other shows? But I did meet quite a few people who were there for the Fringe Festival. And then I did meet a family from Texas who was in Edinburgh on vacation and didn't know the Fringe Festival was there.
Whoa.
And I said, "Oh, well, how did you react to that?" And they were like, "This is the best thing that's ever happened. Like, we were so excited that there's all these things to do." And so they were glad that they happened on the Fringe, which I can't imagine happening on the Fringe. No. But
wow, that's interesting. That's like when Kathy and I went to New York City this earlier this summer, and we just purely by coincidence, we were there for World Pride that very same weekend, and it was amazing. But I mean, that was just like a fun little bonus that we didn't know we hadn't bargained for, but it was exciting to be there.
But I do think the Fringe has a pretty good reputation, and there are people from all over the world. Mm. You hear all kinds of accents and all kinds of people. So
I would love to go back. I think it's just an amazing thing, you know. So it's a beautiful city. People were charming and wonderful. The food was good. You know, if you're okay with rain, then you're okay. It rains pretty much every day. But to me, that was just part of the experience. It's raining, you know, in Scotland. That's supposed to.
You'd be sad if it didn't.
Yeah, right. Well, where's the sheep? I need to see sheep, you know. And
the phrase was, just wait 20 minutes and the weather will change. So it'll be different.
So did you have plenty of time to do anything else aside from the Fringe Festival, or did that eat up your energy and your time?
Oh, no, we, you know, we spent a little chunk of each day in different groups, what you call busking, which is you're out on the Royal Mile, handing out your flyers, talking to people, trying to talk up your show. So our students did that for a little bit of the day, but then they had the rest of the day to do other things, which you could go to museums, or the Edinburgh Castle is there, which is a really cool working castle, right? They still use it for the military, and some other things. And then we did have a couple of days where we went outside of Edinburgh and did some castle tours, which was fun.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, and then the tattoo, I think they did a really nice job of organizing some activities for the students to go to. You know, Tattoo is this big military band from bands from all over the world playing, and that's an amazing experience right in front of the castle. And you know,
well, the tattoo is the tattoo is historically the call to the call to arms, basically to come to the castle. We're gonna go, you know, do whatever that thing is. And so they've made it into a really wonderful, like almost 2-hour event where just bagpipe.
Military bands, really.
Bands, military, all from all over UK come and perform, and it's very cool. So we got a chance to do that, too.
As if there wasn't already a whole lot of exciting stuff to experience.
Exactly.
So, Doug, is this theoretically something that, for instance, the Racine Theater Guild could talk about doing someday? And do you entertain any thoughts at all about
it? I did. I actually went on the web site when I got back on how to produce a show. It's all very vague. You know, oh, between 3,000 and 5,000 for this and 2,000 and 4,000 for that. And I think it absolutely is something to do. However, it's a different experience. You don't bring a show to the Fringe Festival to make a lot of money. You go there for the experience. And like Kim said, many companies were trying out new material. In fact, we went to a comedian who plays all over the world who had a sheet. He said, okay, I'm going to try this joke. Was this funny? Nope, cross that one off. And really? He was using us as a test subject. Wow. And that was fun. And it was kind of exciting to see something new and that this guy was working on. And, you know, things that you won't normally get to see. And like I said, there's some of the houses only have 40 seats in them. And they're paying, you know, £10 or £8. So it's not a huge moneymaker. It's all about the experience and learning and art, you know, and it's okay to go and experience art. And I told Herschel that I was those students are so lucky to be able to go to a place with all these artists and experience these things. Because when you get to America, I got to do Greece, and I got to do Annie, and I got to do Oklahoma.
Right.
You know, I don't get to see Styx, and I don't get to see weird Frankenstein, and I don't get to see those things. And it's a wonderful educational experience, and I learned so much, and I was so grateful to be able to see things that I wouldn't be able to see, that wouldn't be viable. Maybe in the United States.
Right, but work in the Fringe Festival,
right,
for sure. Kim, real quick, what determines if Carthage takes a play? I mean, what prompted Carthage to take Up and Away by Eric Simonson to the Fringe Festival? Or, I mean, is there anything that keeps you from going every single year?
Money.
Yeah, crazy. Yeah.
I think Herschel Kruger is sort of the person who started this idea that we should travel and do performances in other places. And so we are trying to loosely do a schedule of like every 3 years, go to some kind of festival, some kind of place and perform. And we have done, so we started with the Fringe. We took No Name, and then we did a collaboration with the Gaiety Theatre in Dublin, and we took a show to Dublin to perform. And then we went to the Crisis Art Festival in Arezzo, Italy, and performed a show. And then now we've gone back to the Fringe. So I think it's just, you know, it's a curricular model for us that we really think it's important to travel a show, to go see a foreign country. Like Doug said, you know, it's a great educational thing to see things that are not going to be necessarily American. I'm not sure how the idea happened, but I'm certainly glad that it did, because I went to all four of those trips.
Yeah,
so
that's fabulous. It's a little bit like choirs taking tours
absolutely.
To hither and yon, and broadens a young student's life in all kinds of ways. Well, as I figured, this has been an absolutely wonderful conversation. I so appreciate both of you being such vivid storytellers and kind of talking about what it was like to be in the midst of the Edinburgh Festival Fringe, or Fringe Festival as it's come to be affectionately known. Kim Instanis, Doug Instanis, I have really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm glad that you had so much fun at the Fringe Festival and took time in your busy schedules to tell us about it on The Morning Show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll be hearing from Eric Berry, mandolin player and a charter member of the wonderful bluegrass band Trampled by Turtles. They're the headliners for Sunday's Labor of Love Music Fest out in New Munster. Also, we'll talk with the creator of a program called Project Merit that assists high school students in creating meaningful and impressive community projects. On Friday, we'll learn about some of the young people who were part of the resistance in France during the Second World War when France was occupied by Nazi Germany. Ronald Rossbottom's book is titled Sudden Courage. Support for WGTD comes from Jack and Drea, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's Morning Show. We remind you that you can subscribe to The Morning Show as a podcast via Spotify, Google Podcast, or Apple Podcast.